Hello, friends. So great that we can once again gather together, even though we're apart. You should know your lovable Keystone staff continues to tirelessly work to make this online experience the best it can possibly be. You may have already noticed a couple of changes. For example, last week I traded in the music stand I've used to hold my notes for 20 years for a screen. I know, progress has been made. I even have a clicker that turns the page of my notes. We are so high tech around here. Additionally, and in answer to your many emails, I'm still waiting to hear from our friends at Amway Corporation's Artistry Cosmetics Division about sponsoring my makeup for the weekend services. Apparently, as many of you have said, I am not necessarily naturally TV compliant, and I'm hoping that the professionals down the road may be able to help. So anyway, today we get to conclude a series we've called Contact. And in it, we've been exploring some of the earliest stories found in the Bible. They record some of the first times in history God made contact with human beings. It's a fascinating study because I'm convinced that the way God first chose to reveal himself tells us a lot about the things he values and the sort of relationship he desires to build with people. People like you and me. Now, as many of you know, this series is built around the accounts of the lives of five guys found in the book of Genesis. Their names are Adam and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. And today we get to unpack some of Joseph's story. And by the way, this isn't the Joseph you may remember from the Christmas story, the Mary and Joseph. This Joseph lived thousands of years earlier and was a part of a very special family. His great-grandpa, a man named Abraham, was chosen by God to be the father of a nation through which God would one day bless the entire world. And then that promise had been passed on to Jacob's grandfather, Isaac, and his father, Jacob, who was later renamed Israel. And as we enter the story today, the promise has rested on Joseph and his 11 brothers. Now, I want to begin our study with a question that I think is really front and center in Joseph's life. And it's a question we've all asked from time to time. In fact, I'm convinced that more than a few of us have asked it in the past few weeks. The question goes like this. What do you do when you don't know what to do? What do you do when you don't know what to do? In other words, what should you do when life doesn't go as planned and you find yourself disoriented, frustrated, and confused? When the map and timeline you have for your future is no longer relevant, and you're not sure when or even if things will ever get back to normal? What can you do when something outside of your control disrupts your plans, vocationally, relationally, financially, or physically? See what I mean? Anybody else been asking these questions lately? I mean, imagine you're a senior in high school, and 2 months ago you were dreaming of the day you'd walk across the stage and receive your diploma, and then you and your friends were going to go spend the night at an all-night party celebrating the fact that you'd reached a significant milestone together. Then you planned to spend your summer working in preparation for the time you'd drive across the state or across the city to move into a dorm this fall. But now, because of matters well beyond your control, everything has changed. I mean, the gathering for graduation is off. They're trying some sort of virtual online graduation. The after party is off as well. Your summer job is up in the air, and you're waiting to receive word from your college about what's going to happen this fall. I mean, life has taken an unexpected and unwelcomed turn. And you're disappointed, and you're frustrated, and you're confused. Just a question, what do you do when you don't know what to do? Or imagine your marriage has been in a downward spiral for a long time, and you'd spent the past fall and winter talking to friends and counselors. You're doing some of the right things, but the situation continues to get worse. Heading into the lockdown, you were barely managing your marriage, and then you were told to shelter in place for 8 weeks. At least. Just an observation, being forced to spend a significant amount of time with someone with whom you are struggling relationally generally doesn't make the relationship better. And it hasn't. I mean, if you're honest, divorce eventually seems inevitable. But the unexpected financial uncertainty of this season has made even the thought of that more complicated. You think, you know, this wasn't part of the plan. This wasn't supposed to happen. Life has taken an unexpected, an unwelcomed turn, and you're disappointed, and you're frustrated, and you're confused. And just a question, what do you do when you don't know what to do? Maybe just one more. Imagine that you're a small business owner and you've spent the past decade building a business that is making a real difference in our community. And you love your employees and you're proud of the way they serve. And you were on track to have the best year in your history. You were finally going to be rewarded for all your hard work. And now everything feels different. I mean, your business wasn't considered essential. And your staff had to be furloughed. And you're thankful the federal unemployment supplement for your people means that they're going to be able to feed their kids and pay their mortgage. But beyond that, you find yourself staring at the ceiling at night wondering, when are things going to get back to normal? And then maybe this question, will things get back to normal? And then finally, like, can our business survive if there's a radically different version of normal? I mean, life has taken an unexpected and unwelcome turn, and you're disappointed. And you're frustrated and you're confused. Let me ask you, what do you do when you don't know what to do? Well, you should know we're not the first people to ask this question. In fact, people have been asking this question for as long as there have been people. Life is full of unexpected twists and turns. Avoiding disruption is impossible. But you should know something else, too. I'm convinced that what we do and don't do in times of disruption can radically shape who we become when we eventually exit the disruption by returning to normal or by coming into a new normal. And somehow, I find hope there. And my prayer as I prepared for today is that you would as well. Which brings me to Joseph's story. With the rest of our time today, I want to explore what Joseph chose to do when he encountered a series of unexpected life disruptions. When life didn't go as planned. I want to explore what Joseph did when he didn't know what to do. Because I think his story has the power to inspire us as we navigate the current season. Okay, let's jump in. The author of Genesis sets it up for us this way. He says, Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers. And he brought their father a bad report about them. And it's interesting, in this first verse, we learn that Joseph, well, he's a tattletale, and everyone loves tattletales, right? One day, he runs in from the fields and gives an update to his dad. The brothers are not tending the flocks like he believes they should tend the flocks, which, of course, makes me wonder what the brothers were doing with the sheep to merit a bad report. I mean, were they were hanging out in a field with sheep. What could possibly go wrong? And I was curious and had a bit of time this week, so I Googled it. Here's what I found. Apparently, you can tip a sheep. Yes, friends, sheep tipping is actually a thing. So good. If you're bored later today and have access to a sheep, totally give it a try. Anyway, Joseph is not pleased with something they're doing or not doing, so he goes to his dad to complain about them. Now, as the story continues, we learn that Joseph and his dad, well, they had a very special relationship. The author of Genesis tells us, now Israel, that's the dad, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age. And he made an ornate robe for him. Now, if you're a fan of Broadway, you probably know the robe we're talking about. In any case, Joseph's father, Israel, shows a spectacular lack of judgment in giving Joseph the robe. And it's not that Joseph gets a robe. That's fine. It's that his brothers, well, they don't get a robe. And the robe confirmed what they had always suspected. Joseph was the favorite son. Now, some scholars suggest that the coat signified that Joseph would one day receive a double portion of inheritance And that was generally reserved for the firstborn son. But see, Joseph was 11th in the birth order. But the author wants us to know he was number one in his dad's heart. I'm sure his brothers didn't care that much. Maybe they did. The story continues. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. And Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more, which of course raises the question, what was the dream? Well, the dream, as the author of Genesis explains it, it was weird. In the dream, Joseph and each of his brothers were represented by sheaves of grain. Now, if you don't know what a sheaf of grain is, I Googled it for you. It's basically a bunch of grain. And in the dream, Joseph's sheaf rose up and the other sheaves bowed down to it. It's almost like Joseph says to his brothers, hey, I don't know what this means. I think it's prophetic. One day you're going to bow before me at my glory. So to be clear, having the dream isn't the problem. Sharing the dream is the problem. Just notice with me, as the story begins, we're set up for conflict. I mean, some of it is God's fault. He gave Joseph the dreams. Some of it was Joseph's dad's fault. He played favorites. And some of it's Joseph's fault. He wasn't wise in what he shared with his brothers. Well, one afternoon, Israel sends Joseph out to the field again to check on his brothers again. Apparently, that's something Joseph did fairly often. And according to the text, the brothers have moved the flock miles away from home. And so as Joseph approaches, the brothers look up and say, oh, look, here comes Dream Boy. Now's our chance to get rid of him once and for all. The author describes what happened this way. He tells us, so when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty, and there was no water in it. So all over the Middle East, in the ancient world, you found these cisterns, basically shafts in the ground where water was kept. Now, as the story continues, they tell us what happens next. The author writes, as they sat down to eat their meal, as in after Joseph is in the cistern, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Just notice something with me. In a moment, Joseph's life and dreams are disrupted. In a moment, everything changes. His brothers throw him into a cistern, and they sit down, and they have lunch, and they ignore his cries. I mean, from Joseph's perspective, this is unbelievable. He was the favorite son. He's a child of the promise, and it was God who did the promising. And this wasn't supposed to happen. This was an unwelcomed and unexpected disruption. Well, the brothers eventually look up and see the caravan heading to Egypt, and one of them has an idea. The author of Genesis records it this way. Judah, one of the brothers, said to the others, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? He says, come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. And then this, I love this. It's like mercy rises up in his heart. After all, he is our brother. We can't kill him. We should sell him. Our own flesh and blood. And his brothers agreed. It's almost like, you know, if we just kill him, then it ends there. But if we sell him, then we get something for him. And everyone likes the idea. And so as the story continues, the author tells us, so when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels. 10 of the brothers were there. They each get a couple shekels. 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. And at this point, we need to stop the story and ask a few questions, beginning with this one. Where is God in all of this? I mean, would God allow something like this to happen to someone he cares about? Those are great questions. In fact, I would argue they're questions all of us ask when we find our lives and dreams disrupted, when our circumstances begin to ask questions of our faith. Well, the story continues, and the author tells us that now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. So visualize this with me. The Ishmaelite traders get to Egypt and they put Joseph up on the auction block. And potential buyers walk by and examine him physically. Then they ask him questions to gauge his intellect. Then it just so happened that one of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, one of Pharaoh's inner circle, needed a slave. And so he buys Joseph. Well, as the story continues, the next verse contains a phrase that for me changes everything about this story. The author of Genesis records, the Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. The Lord was with Joseph. And I want to call time out. I go, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. At least not at first. I mean, we think, well, if the Lord was with Joseph, he'd be at home with his mom and dad. If the Lord was with Joseph, then good things would happen to him. If I'm Joseph, I'm thinking, you know, I don't want God to be with me when I'm in slavery. I don't want God with me here. I want God with me there. I got to ask you a question. You ever felt that way? Maybe even this week? I think it's natural for this feeling to surface when life is unexpectedly disrupted, when things don't go as planned. It's all too natural for us to question God's care. We find ourselves thinking, you know, doesn't he see? Doesn't he hear? Isn't he concerned? Doesn't he love me? But Joseph's story suggests something, and it's absolutely stunning. Is it possible that even though life has been interrupted and your plans and hopes and dreams are on hold, is it possible that even though we may never get back to normal, God is still at work? Is it possible that even right now, God is telling a good story with your life? It's just a story with some really challenging parts? And I've been a pastor for 20 years. I'm convinced it is. Moreover, as I see it, Joseph's story contains a sort of invitation to all of us. It goes like this. God invites you to trust that he is with you, whatever your circumstances. As your life and plans are disrupted, he invites you to pray. Pray things like, God, remind me that you're telling a good story, even when it doesn't seem like it. Help me to believe that you're at work, even in the midst of my mess. Well, time passes and Joseph prospers. The author of Genesis describes it this way. He tells us that when his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. He goes on, Potiphar put him in charge of his household and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. And then I love this last part. He tells us, so Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. And with Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. And just notice two things about this story with me. One of them is stated implicitly and the other is implied. The first is that God is present and is blessing Joseph in the midst of his radical life disruption. Well, which brings up an interesting question, something to wrestle down. I mean, what if God desires to be with you on yours as we navigate our unprecedented disruption? And to be clear, God's presence with Joseph does not manifest itself by Joseph getting back to normal. In fact, Egypt becomes Joseph's new normal. He's going to die in Egypt. In fact, his dying request was to ask his sons to take his body back home someday. Nonetheless, God is faithful in Joseph's disruption and through Joseph's disruption. When the bottom fell out of Joseph's life, God was with him. That's the first thing that we need to notice. And the second thing we need to pay attention to is the faithfulness of Joseph. I mean, Joseph wasn't sitting around pouting with his arms folded. Apparently, he applies himself each and every day. He wakes up in the morning in the midst of a reality he did not choose and that he does not like, and he chooses to believe that God is faithful, and he takes the next right step forward. He chooses to control what he can control, and he chooses to trust God with the rest. In other words, when Joseph's life and Joseph's plans are disrupted, God is faithful and present, and Joseph is faithful and present. Joseph doesn't zone out, numb out, or check out. He keeps moving forward. He stays focused and does what he knows to do. And God meets him powerfully in that space. Friends, if we're honest, when we're somewhere we don't want to be, locking in and getting to work isn't easy. It takes an incredible amount of courage, but it's the right thing to do. It's the wise thing to do. It's the best thing to do. In fact, it's what you should do when you don't know what to do. As a rule, I hate refrigerator magnets. You have that one friend who spends way too much time at Hobby Lobby, and their refrigerator is covered with small, colorful magnets with cute sayings on them. And I generally can't stand them, but I must confess that they often ring true. Years ago, I encountered one that I found graphically horrific and yet profoundly insightful. It said this: bloom where you're planted. A few of you have this on your refrigerator, and I've insulted your decor. I apologize. But bloom where you're planted. It's almost like sometimes we have to bloom where we're planted because that's where we are, and we don't have any other choice. Sometimes our only move is to engage life as it is and take the next step forward. And I know what you're thinking, like in the middle of a reality that's so uncertain, that seems impossible. Or maybe it even seems dishonest, right? It's like we all have points in our life when our prayers seem to bounce off the ceiling and God seems silent and it's tempting to give up hope. And we start to think, well, what am I supposed to do? How do I get through this? And the answer that I think is front and center in Joseph's story is actually quite easy to understand in your head and immensely challenging to embrace in your heart. What do you do when you don't know what to do? You simply do what you would do if you were confident that God was with you in your relational disruption, in your educational disruption, in your vocational disruption, in your financial disruption. You do what you would do if you were confident God was with you, because he is. And because he is, you stay present. You stay connected. You stay engaged. You keep serving. You keep loving. You keep hoping. You keep forgiving. You keep moving forward. Most of all, you choose to believe that God is telling a good story with your life. It's just a good story with some lousy parts. I want to leave you with a few questions to discuss over lunch today. We want to start doing this every week, hopefully to take the content and sort of push it into your life a bit deeper. The questions for today go like this. And you can feel free to take a screenshot if you want to get it later. But question number one: what is your greatest concern in the current interruption? What is your greatest concern in the current interruption? If you're waking up at night and your mind is spinning, what really front and center for you is your greatest fear or your greatest concern? Number two, how has the current interruption impacted your faith? For some of you, you'd say, you know what? It really hasn't. For others of you, you would say, man, I think the current interruption has brought my faith right front and center, and I am hungry to connect with God in a way that I never have before. I mean, our podcast numbers, friends, have never been so high, which means there's a whole bunch of you that this may be the first time you're connecting with us at Keystone. And if that's you, welcome. We cannot wait to meet you and to hand you some popcorn. And I know that sounds weird, but just trust me, it'll be just fine when you visit us when the building reopens. But how has the current interruption impacted your faith? For some of you, it's been a challenge. For others of you, it has been incredibly catalytic. And finally, number three, is it hard for you to believe that God is with you right now? Is it hard for you to believe that God is with you right now? And I would just plead with you, be honest. Your honesty will unlock the honesty of others. It's part of appropriate vulnerability, and it makes our relationship so much richer and so much deeper. As we close, would you let me pray over all of us? Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for preserving the ancient story of Joseph. We thank you that one of the first things you wanted us to understand, one of the first messages you sent to humanity when you made contact, was that whatever our circumstances, you are with us, and you are at work in the middle of our mess. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for believing in us. Most of all, we thank you that you sent your one and only Son to earth as one of us to show us the way and the truth and the life. I ask for your grace and your peace to be on us all as we continue to navigate life interrupted. May we do so with grace and peace and love. It is in the matchless name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. Friends, it has been awesome to be with you. Grace and peace be upon you. We'll see you next week.